From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a new book illustrates the face of the civil rights movement in the North, including in Milwaukee.
Then the creator of the controversial artwork Eggs Benedict is back with a new piece that celebrates Planned Parenthood.
I knew that I needed to strike the right balance in order to draw attention effectively to the value of women's reproductive rights, how when we're torn down, we will rise.
Essayist J.F. Reardon examines the divisions between rural and urban America.
And Theater Red launches a new play based on the real American pirate, Anne Bonny.
It's highly fictionalized, so think something more along the lines of Braveheart, where we use the ideas and the spirit of these characters, but we use them to tell this really fun high seas adventure story.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. Good morning. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. When we think about the modern civil rights era, there are many images that come to mind. Crowds of people holding signs, policemen attacking children with dogs and fire hoses, students sitting at lunch counters with jeering crowds behind them.
For many Americans, these images form our view of that time period and frame the fight for civil rights as a largely Southern issue. But historian and author Mark Speltz is hoping to change that image. His book, North of Dixie, features images from cities like Detroit, Chicago, and Milwaukee during the civil rights era.
Speltz is a senior historian at American Girl and a graduate from UWM. He joined me in studio to talk about the ways photos impact our understanding of history and his inspiration for this book.
Well, I started at UWM and I was taking a visual culture and photography class in 2007. And we were asked to select a photograph and interpret it and interrogate and talk about it. And I knew I wanted to do civil rights photography. I've always been incredibly moved by the compelling and powerful photographs. And so when I was looking at some iconic photographs from 1963 of a sit-in in Jackson, Mississippi. And I then, in my other hand, at the UWM archives, held a Milwaukee photograph from August 1967. And I had never seen it before. And I looked at it, and there was an interracial group of marchers, the NAACP, Milwaukee Youth Council, marching through the South Side. But there were police officers with guns pulled, pointing into the air, escorting them through. And I thought, well, that's odd. Why are they doing that? And what I came to learn was they were going through this neighborhood and they were intensely angry about it and throwing rocks and bags of urine and firecrackers. Whites from the sidewalks did not like this intrusion, this protest. And it was incredibly contested. So the photograph opened up a whole new world for me that I wasn't aware of, the civil rights movement in the North. My advisor was working on the 40th anniversary celebrations at the time, so open housing, conferences, there were oral history projects. And I began to understand what this meant to the community and how the photographs we see now help us understand that time period.
Having learned history of the civil rights era in Wisconsin, I can say that most of the images I remember, they are from places like Mississippi, Alabama, Arkansas. When I came to Milwaukee, I was surprised to learn things about the civil rights history. And I think part of that is the lack of imagery and kind of the lack of conversation. Do you think the two play into one another? Like the lack of images is part of why we don't talk about it as much?
I think that's exactly right. You don't see them in textbooks. Our textbooks tell a very Southern story. They tell a very aggressive, violent story with the photographs. You see people being attacked. You see brutalized black bodies. You don't see African Americans standing up and making change themselves. You don't often see images that show agency. You see them, you know, being washed down a sidewalk in Birmingham. Or you see a very charismatic male leader speaking at, you know, the March on Washington. Those are the pictures you see. Now, kids in Milwaukee, they might come across a few pictures in local textbooks or local packets. But once you move out further, I grew up in Minnesota. I had never seen those photographs before. I wasn't familiar with what happened in Chicago. And I don't think that that's necessarily the fault of educators or maybe even textbook writers. I think it's how we've been trained to think about the civil rights movement, both from when it was happening to now, how we educate our children. While it was happening, the press, the Northern press, would much rather point a finger at the Southern part of the nation. It was easier to frame. It was easier storylines to follow. It made you feel better about your own communities. But these same issues and more, and some that were more pervasive, were, you know, boiling up and boiling over in the neighborhoods. I think that the Northern press, when they did have to cover it, they covered it in a very similar way. Like on Milwaukee's newspapers, you would see whites rioting. You'd see tear gas. You'd see angry whites fighting with the police. But what you didn't see were the marchers themselves very often. In fact, in the first 2 weeks, over 75% of the photographs featured whites, police, politicians like the mayor, but not Father Grappi and the African-American youth who were leading the struggle. So I think that that's part and parcel for how the community covered it. If you're going to cover it, it focused on the most attention-grabbing issues. Other times it would be buried to the back pages.
Do we know why that is?
I think that it's a lot of, you know, you don't want to make your community look real bad. In Detroit, there were lots of complaints of police brutality in the 1950s and 60s. And the Detroit NAACP would take photographs of people who came in and gave their story and did an affidavit, and they would be bruised and battered, and there would be blood on their jackets. And these photographs then would be sent to the press, the white press, the black press, and only the black press would run it. Between 1956 and 1960, there were 150 allegations of police brutality, and a third of those, the NAACP found, that they happened in police custody. So these photographs helped expose this invisible example of abuse. Now, I think students today, if they see these photographs in textbooks nationally, they'll start to understand that the struggle was coast to coast. They'll see that ordinary Americans, like their parents and their grandparents and their great-grandparents, took part in these types of struggles. They didn't wait for Dr. King to come to their community or some other well-known civil rights leader. They made change on their own. These struggles were built, conceived of, and waged locally by ordinary Americans.
When we look at the images in the book, especially of Chicago, a lot of the Art Shea images, to me, it seems like we're looking at people in the South. You know, in one, they're holding Confederate flags. You know, they're screaming in this way that we think of as being so indicative of these images from Alabama and Mississippi. And in that same way, when we look at the images from Milwaukee, we have that same kind of sense, at least in my mind. And both of these cities are still dealing with this kind of lasting segregation. How do these images help us fill in kind of our cultural knowledge gaps about our own cities?
I think seeing the photographs of people from Milwaukee or Chicago holding Confederate flags and angry at civil rights protesters, they complicate our understanding of the civil rights struggle, how we remember it. We think of it as a celebratory tale. There are many things to celebrate, important speeches, important legislative acts, and really important moments. But when we bring the North into the picture, it complicates it. There's a lot of things that are left undone, issues that we still grapple with. And I think that the photos give us that historical context. So if you grow up thinking, you know, freedom in the North wasn't the promised land that we like to think it was. There were an incredible amount of issues that blacks dealt with. There was housing segregation, workplace discrimination. There was over-policing and poor police and community relations, urban renewal. There was poor city services and trash collection, things that people dealt with in their daily life. So I think that the pictures and whites' reaction to people protesting change the way you look at it, and that helps us reassess our assumptions about the past.
A lot of what you mention, specifically urban renewal, a lot of the issues that we're dealing with, they're these things that can't always be pictured. And there isn't always an image associated with it. Do you think that that affects our ability to understand these issues?
I think the photographs that you see coming out of the North had to work a lot harder to visualize and make visible certain issues. You couldn't capture a lender saying no to somebody at a bank. I mean, I looked. I searched through JET looking for those African-American families outside of a bank, well-dressed, but unhappy because they couldn't get a loan photos. They didn't really exist. But I did find pictures from Look magazine in Philadelphia where you saw that same family walking into a neighborhood and staring at a house that they just loved and it fit what they wanted. There was a for sale sign out front, yet they knew they couldn't buy in that particular neighborhood. So photographers worked very hard to capture that sentiment, that feeling. Now, the way that activists could really make the issue visible was by marching onto the South Side in Milwaukee or through a different part of Chicago where they knew they would get a reaction. And that reaction would then get into the newspapers and onto the television news and call attention to the issue. Now, in Milwaukee, we see that the activists themselves are not what the focus is on. After the first 2 weeks of the struggle here, the open housing struggle in 1967, the press tended to focus on everybody but them. But they still raised attention and called attention to the issue, which is important. I think when we look at the Southern photographs, it's very easy to see four students sitting at a lunch counter and not being served. And they're just sitting there politely and reading a book and studying. They're nonviolent. They're not getting any help. Or on the other side, you can see people sitting there and having ketchup and mustard poured all over them, sugar poured over their heads, people threatening them, very dangerous situation. Those ones are very easy to read. You know exactly what's going on. Now in the North, when you marched into a neighborhood, you know, that picture from Milwaukee with police guards with guns drawn, escorting a group through a neighborhood, that's not a quick read. You're not sure what's going on there. And they're not as black and white and as easy to read as the Southern photos.
So what are the images that we're going to see from Milwaukee in your book, North of Dixie?
Well, I included about three or four. There's a really strong one from JET magazine that I like a lot, and it shows Dick Gregory, Val Phillips, and Father Groppi. And they're all looking back at the march and looking at some of the counter-protesters. But there's a steely look of determination on each of their faces. And I've always loved that photograph. It ran in JET magazine right after the marches. JET magazine covered Milwaukee for about 3 to 4 consecutive weeks. A lot of photographs were there. Those were seen by over 500,000 subscribers. And then that magazine was passed around, you know, at church and in barbershops. So Milwaukee's struggle was seen nationally. But it's not necessarily remembered nationally today like other Southern struggles. Another one of my favorite photos in the book, I came across it early on during my research. It ran, I think, on the third day of the struggles. There were arrests outside of the Freedom House after it had been burnt out. There's this incredible photograph of a woman who's in one hand holding her purse and a police officer's baton. Her right hand is straight up in his face, pushing him away. And what this photograph said to me 50 years later was, not everybody chose to go smoothly. Not everybody was willing to be lifted limply into a paddy wagon. Nonviolence was chosen by many, but not everybody. She was willing to struggle. She was willing to fight. And this ran on the front page of the Milwaukee Journal. Now, not everybody read the journal, but I think that a lot of people saw it and were inspired by her actions and came out to join the marches after that. In fact, I heard that from several people who were active in the marches, that photographs of arrest scenes, police interactions were inspiring. They did make them want to come out.
So why is this a conversation that you're resurrecting 50 years later? Why is this a conversation that is still important?
I think this is an incredibly important book for two reasons. Number one, it provides a lot of context to what we're seeing today. Me personally, I hadn't even thought of St. Louis and Ferguson before 2014. And that sounds awful to say, but I was not aware of the civil rights struggles that were taking place there. I was beginning work on this, and as I was reading about Ferguson, a couple weeks later, I would start to see photograph galleries on the St. Louis newspaper websites that would show historic photos from St. Louis. And my eyes would open up and go, there were decades worth of struggles there before this. There were a lot of different issues. There were hiring problems. There were protests against banks that wouldn't lend to blacks. All sorts of struggles that I saw elsewhere in the North and West. And that context was not available to the average person before Ferguson popped up. So I think nationwide, the book helps provide historical context to what we're seeing now on a whole range of issues. I think it also provides hope and is inspiring. The photos help people understand that it wasn't civil rights leaders taking every step, planning every campaign. All the local campaigns were led locally. They were fought locally, and they were either won or lost locally. And many of them continue yet today.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Speltz is the author of North of Dixie, Civil Rights Photography Beyond the South. He's also a senior historian at American Girl, and he lives in Madison. Speltz will be at Boswell Books tonight for an event at 7 o'clock. There is more information at WUWM.com.
Milwaukee artist Nikki Johnson unveiled a new work earlier this month. We'll talk about Hills and Valleys next on Lake Effect here on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Keep on! Now maybe someday I'll reach that higher goal.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. The feminist icon Gloria Steinem was in Milwaukee earlier this month to celebrate the 80th anniversary of the organization Planned Parenthood of Wisconsin. Milwaukee artist Nikki Johnson was a part of the event, unveiling a new work called Hills and Valleys. The work is constructed from signs collected from now shuttered Planned Parenthood offices around the state, which have been defunded during the current gubernatorial administration.
Johnson is no stranger to controversial artwork. Her 2013 piece, Eggs Benedict, is a portrait of then-Pope Benedict woven out of condoms. That piece became part of the Milwaukee Art Museum's permanent collection last year. Well, Nikki Johnson joins us in the studio now to talk about this latest work. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bonnie.
We had to have you in because you just had an amazing piece unveiled at the Planned Parenthood luncheon last week. And so tell me about it and what makes it so special to you.
Well, I mean, being part of that event was just really kind of a lifetime achievement. Gloria Steinem was the keynote speaker who has been a hero in my household from, well, before I was born. So it was personally meaningful to me, but also to many of my family members who came across the country and sat at my table to see.
So what is the piece?
The piece is called Hills and Valleys, and it is a portrait of a woman's hips with a vajazzle of the U.S. Capitol made out of mirror in the center. And the hips are framed by a quilt pattern. The pattern is called Sarah's Choice. Both the quilt pattern and the dots that create the kind of the stipple effect of the hips, that is made out of the signs from Planned Parenthoods that have been defunded under the Walker administration here in Wisconsin.
How did you find them? How did you get those materials?
I've been a supporter and a donor to Planned Parenthood for years, and I was made aware back in the fall of 2013 that there were a number of signs that were going to be heading out to recycling that were on their back dock.
And so these were signs that basically said Planned Parenthood of or something like that.
Right. They would be like what you saw if you were driving down the road and looking for a healthcare center.
Right. So it has particular colors and that particular lettering that they have.
All of them were green and white. It was a very Girl Scout cookie.
And so you used all of those. You chopped them up in various ways.
Well, just to tell you a bit about my process, I usually work idea to material. This was a little different because now I had this material and I didn't have an idea to go with it. And beyond that, the material itself, to me, felt sacred. I mean, it was both a beautiful and amazing thing to pull into my garage and see because of how I feel about Planned Parenthood and what they do for women and families across the country. But it was kind of like a graveyard at the same time. I had to sit with the material. I didn't want to hurry it. I knew that I needed to strike the right balance in order to draw attention effectively to the value of women's reproductive rights, how when we're torn down, we will rise, and to really just bring a second and possibly more enlightened life to something that had been set, well, kind of by the garbage.
So you sat with it for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
How did that first idea, that first inkling, or what was the first inkling that came to you about how to use the materials and what it was that you wanted to say?
So in 2009, I mean, it's kind of this alphabet soup. You know, like every time I make a piece, that you know, some of the information comes from years before, some did something I learned recently, and then usually right before I fall asleep, it all glues together into an image. And if I'm in the right place, I'll sit up and draw, you know, some terrible drawing and then go to sleep and wake up in the morning and see if that was any good. That drawing happened in October of 2015. So just a little under.
Oh, maybe it was about a year ago. Yeah.
Yeah. With this idea of alphabet soup and having many elements contribute to the piece. In 2009, I had the fortune of working with a friend and mentor of mine in Memphis, Tennessee. His name is Greeley Myatt. And Greeley had taken a number of road signs that, you know, the reflective kind, and was cutting them down into quilt patterns. And I just loved the way that when the material was cut apart, it was so smart, you know. It turned into, it feminized the material. It softened this kind of hard industrial language and brought it back to narratives of the domestic. And there's something to be said about, you know, how the environments around us also play into our home lives, right? So just, it was a really wonderful and eye-opening moment to work with Greeley. And so when I saw the signs, of course, I thought of his quilt. And when the drawing popped up and years later and the hips were there with a quilt behind them, I called Greeley immediately. And I said, would this be okay if I incorporated part of your language into this? And he's great. He was like, of course. So check. Got the quilt. And when I was looking through quilt patterns, it was important to me that the title of the quilt, that first of all, it would be a traditional American pattern, and then also that the title of the quilt would tie into the politics of the piece. And so I picked a traditional star pattern called Sarah's Choice. The next part in putting this piece together happened during a car ride with a handful of employees who were working with me on making a public art piece in the summer of 2015. And somewhere along the line, somebody brought up the term vajazzle. And I have to admit, like, my inner feminist I was just hit with boredom. I was just like, waxed pubic mounds, you know, like bring it back to this like need to take the adult woman's body and make it look like a little girl's body. And then, you know, and then what, you put rhinestones on it? I mean, I don't even eat crackers in bed. I don't know how that would be an appealing thing to do. So I went home and immediately Googled it. And
I don't even want to know what that search looked like.
Well, there was something about the way that the kind of like hardcore nature of the glistening Hello Kitties and like LOLs and unicorns that I saw, they stayed with me for 2 days. And at that point, I realized that I wasn't bored. It didn't sit right, but that's usually when I know that there's material there to work with. And I realized that vajazzle is something that people are spending their hard-earned money on. It's a form of self-expression. It sits comfortably in the family of fetishism. And that if people are taking care of themselves and that's what they're into, who am I to judge? Just to go to the next piece in the puzzle, 2010, in graduate school, I was commuting in from Lake Mills, and I was going to UW-Madison. So every day I would drive to the base of the Capitol building. It took a few months before I realized that I was really looking forward to that drive, specifically because of this kind of like, experience I was having when I was driving up to the base of the Capitol. And I thought, there's something there. So I started to investigate because I've never had like a quasi-spiritual experience with a government building. I started going on the guided tours like every week for like 10 weeks and really looking at the paintings and starting to unpack the meta narrative of state, of power, of how it is that the government or our state government in particular wants you to understand it. The silhouette of the state capitol has shown up in my work. Now, this is the U.S. Capitol that's on hills and valleys, on the hips. But yeah, so those were like the three main parts that somehow collided. So I had the idea, but I didn't have the shop.
And then you had the shop.
Well,
yeah.
A friend of mine said, oh, hey, you know, I'm doing a sabbatical replacement over at UWM. Glenn Williams is his name. And Glenn said, would you be interested in coming by and talking with my students? And I said, absolutely. He said, you know, if there's a project you want to work on with them at the same time and they can see how you work, you're more than welcome to use the shop. So I began working with Glenn's students. And this also allowed me to cut these giant signs into 1-inch strips. Cutting down the signs was probably one of the most emotionally upsetting experiences I've had in a really long time. I realized that I was physically partaking in the action of what legislators across our country are trying to do to women's reproductive rights. I was physically cutting in and cutting apart, deconstructing the signs piece by piece. It was only when I brought out the jeweler's punch and began punching circles out of them. Circles are friendly. And separating the signs into these little parts that I began to see parts that could build something whole again. And that was pretty much the aha. And that is really when the project started picking up steam. When I began punching the dots, I realized that I was either going to need a shoulder replacement or like maybe 2 more years to make the piece because I should have measured major square footage. The portrait is filled with these dots from the signage. So I reached out to Facebook and I put a call out on Facebook and said, do you believe in women's reproductive rights? And are you good with a hammer? If so, please message me. And what happened was 30 people ended up coming and working with me over the course of 2 months in my studio, ages ranging 14 to 75. I've never seen my studio as a space for empowerment. But this is what people expressed as having happened inside the space. It was phenomenal. My studio became a conduit for political action. And I felt many mornings when I got up ready to go in that I was just a very small part of a much larger and meaningful experience.
Have those folks seen the finished product?
Oh, yeah. We've had after parties. I hope look forward to having more with them. And many of these volunteers who taught me the world about volunteer culture and, you know, how very valuable that is, they've become dear friends. I feel even more invested in this community, and I couldn't be more proud or excited to be living in Milwaukee.
Do you think that when people see the finished work, that they're getting that same sense of this is something we could build again, or maybe we have to take a different turn, but that there's hope, I guess, maybe is the question?
I'm not sure. You know, it's always hard to tell, you know, what your audience is going to get from the piece. But
well, how do you feel?
Well, I feel like many of my pieces, even though it's dealing with kind of heavy subject matter, it's doing so in a direct yet playful way. I mean, there's bejazzle involved, right?
Which is just humorous in a way right there.
Right, yeah. Sure. However, all those mirrors are purchased from Hobby Lobby.
On purpose?
Absolutely. Because mm-hmm. I think that, first of all, There's the idea that you see the piece immediately. I mean, hips are beautiful, right? A state capitol, they're always, I mean, U.S. Capitol, it's a beautiful building. It's built to inspire awe. The quilt pattern, it's rhythmic. That's also pleasing. All of the elements within the piece I worked to craft, and also trying to create a tonal pattern, a gradient that follows the body that makes it more lifelike. All of those things were made to draw people in, because I think beauty has a way of getting the audience to open up, as does humor, as does seeing yourself. People love reflection. And I thought for the content of this piece, it was very important that the public see their reflection in it, not only as kind of like a fun celebratory aspect to the work, but also because we need to see ourselves in the future of reproductive rights, which is human rights. And if you aren't happy with who's in office, guess what? You can change it. This is all about empowering people to see themselves as being the ones who create the government we live with. And I think in a time like right now, which of course I could have never predicted, I think it's especially important.
So you unveiled it at the Planned Parenthood luncheon. I assume people responded well.
Yes, that was like a giant family of 1,400 people. What an amazing group of supporters. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what happens to it now? Are you planning to take it out and show it in other places? Are you going to try to take it on the road or send it on the road? Or
I would love to. In fact, I built the piece so it breaks apart into four crates and it is ready to travel nationally. At this point, there are several conversations happening that hopefully will have me on the road through 2017. And I like the idea of her not resting. You know, there's something to be said about being able to see artwork in person. And ideally, I'd like to see this piece help with generating conversation and art activism across the United States. I know that's lofty.
Well, Nikki Johnson, we're so thrilled that you're here.
Thanks for having me, Bonnie.
Milwaukee artist Nikki Johnson's newest work, Hills and Valleys, is on display at Material Studios and Gallery in the Third Ward. You'll find a link to more at WUWM.com.
We'll take another short break now, and then an essayist considers our urban small-town divide. And then Theater Red sets sail on the high seas with historical fiction about female pirates. Keep listening. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. This campaign season has brought many of the divisions this country faces to the foreground.
But beyond the liberal, conservative, black and white, and male and female divides, essayist J.F. Reardon says there's another division that has become a regular part of life in America.
A writer in a national magazine recently theorized that small-town voters who still live where they grew up are insular and unenlightened, stuck in the past, resistant to progress. Having grown up in a small town, and also having taught at a high school in the inner city of Milwaukee, I can say that most of my students and their families were also living in their hometown and the hometown of their families. Does that make them insular, or does it make them normal? City life is fine. It is filled with cultural and social and employment opportunities that may not exist elsewhere. You can choose how and whether to connect with other people. But bustle is not for everyone, nor is anonymity. Some among us choose to live in a different way, but it would be a mistake to believe that small-town life is a bucolic and peaceful existence. Living in a small community is not for the faint of heart. Small towns are a microcosm of the human experience, but with more intensity. You live shoulder to shoulder with your oldest friends and your fiercest enemies. You daily encounter the person who cheated you, who stood you up, who broke your heart, And with people who know your complete history, every bad decision, every embarrassment, every moment of kindness, if any. In cities, there can be the relief of some anonymity, but not in a small town. Living in a small town is a psychologically raw way to live. But small town life also requires a deep connection to community that city people may not acquire. It generally means that you go to church because that is what is expected and what everyone does. It means you are surrounded by people who know you. In the city, it's called networking. In a small town, the network is your neighbors, and you are expected to participate. Your neighbors are the ones who gather around you to celebrate births and mourn deaths. They plow your driveway when you have the flu. They raise money to help in a tragedy. They put an arm around your shoulder. They get mad at you. They make casseroles. And you, in turn, celebrate and mourn and plow and comfort and get angry and bake. This sharing and mutual support is as old as human beings, and it is good. We live in a society in which the elites make a continuing push against the values of faith and decency and common sense. The cultural gatekeepers seem to believe that someone who doesn't live in your community can decide what's wrong with you and what you need. It's an insult, and a barely veiled one. Small towns are part of flyover country, insular, irrelevant bumpkins, filled with prejudices, unable to participate in the enlightened progressivism of the cities, destined never to be famous. But living in a small town means that you are aware of the scorn heaped upon you by city dwellers who think they are better, and you shrug your shoulders and get on with it. Maybe resisting progress isn't all bad. In an age of celebrity and reality television, of Instagram and Twitter, most small-town people live out quiet, uncelebrated lives of dignity and depth. They work, they care for their families and their friends, they mow their lawns and mop their floors. They may not be famous or trendsetting, but they have lives worth living. And that is something worth standing for.
J.F. Reardon is the award-winning author of two novels about small-town life, North of the Tension Line and The Audacity of Goats. No, I cannot forget from where it is that I come from. I cannot forget the people who love me. Yeah, I can be myself here in this small town. And people let me be just what I want to be.
Avast ye hearties. Well, no, it's not International Talk Like a Pirate Day, but it might as well be on the stage of Wisconsin Lutheran College for the next couple of weekends.
Milwaukee's Theater Red produces the world premiere of local playwright Liz Shipes, Bonnie and Bonnie. The play is a female pirate adventure based on real characters from the 18th century. Anne Bonnie and Mary Read didn't want to live the life women of the 1700s were expected to, opting instead for a life of swashbuckling adventure.
Liz Shipes, along with Theater Red co-founder Marcy Daugherty-Elst and actor Alicia Rice, join me in the studio now. Welcome to all three of you.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
Yay.
So Liz, pirates, and even better, women pirates.
Sure.
Yep. How cool is that?
It's very cool. It's really interesting to sit and watch how the relationships develop between all the different types of women, because that's, I think, the biggest challenge of writing a female pirate show is you're writing about women who weren't particularly predominant in that time period. And the stipulations were that they wanted lots of female roles. So you start to try and figure out how you write a show where they don't just all become the alpha female of the ship. And so eventually they start to figure out where they fall into, what role they play in the show and on the ship. And that's been really interesting to watch unfold over the process.
And so, Allie, you are the title
alpha
character.
Pirate.
You're the alpha pirate, yeah.
Yeah.
And how much did you know about women pirates before you started this?
Well, oddly enough, a few years ago at the Public Museum here in Milwaukee, they did a exhibit called Real Pirates, and I was cast as one of the actors in the exhibit as Anne Bonny. So this is my second time around playing this
with
particular
her.
Pirate.
Yeah. And she was so fascinating.
Indeed.
She really was.
What an amazing story that
yeah.
she had. So for those who don't know who Anne Bonny was, give me a little background of who this real person was.
Well, she lived in, I believe, South Carolina at the time. She came from County Cork in Ireland with her father. And at around 19 years old, she just decided to leave the farm. She lived like a well-to-do life, and she was just going to live her life on the seas. And she had a reputation for being fairly bloodthirsty. I mean, I'm pretty sure she would be diagnosed as a psychopath now.
So, I mean, truly not just like wanting the riches, but really getting into the killing.
Loving the adventure.
And the
loving
adventure.
The wildness of pirate life, and really only lived, you know, for a little over a year as a pirate. And then when she was besieged, her and Mary, who was another female pirate, were taken to be hanged, and they pled the belly, which meant they said they were pregnant so that they couldn't be hanged. And then there's no real trace of what happened to her. Just fell off the face of the earth.
Wow. So was she really pregnant when?
That's the question.
We don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I was wondering if there are descendants.
There are accounts that they think they've found some. It's really anybody's guess. And Mary Read, they're pretty sure, did pass away. The story that we tell is a little less grim than that.
Yeah.
It's highly fictionalized. So think something more along the lines of like Braveheart, where we use the ideas and the spirit of these characters, but we use them to tell this really fun high seas adventure story. So historical accuracy, not so much, but it sure is a really fun night at the theater.
Marcy, bringing you in on this conversation, is this something that just really appealed to you?
Absolutely. Actually, this started, I think, Liz, boy, back when we did A Lady in Waiting. So Liz wrote A Lady in Waiting for us. That was the retelling of the Robin Hood adventure from the perspective of Maid Marian and her lady's maid. And when Theater Red did that with Liz, we asked her to write us a female pirate adventure. We got really interested in this idea. And of course, a lot of that has to do with the fact that Christopher is a fight director, and he loves to have fights and shows and loves to have opportunities for women to fight on stage. So that's sort of where this seed got planted. And we asked Liz to write us a story sort of in this framework that featured a lot of female characters. So it's a great opportunity to feature women on stage in roles that you might not ordinarily see them on, and getting to do things they normally don't get to do on stage.
Right. Normally you don't get to wield cutlasses and swords and jump on riggings and that sort of thing. And how much fun is that?
It has been incredibly fun and exhilarating and wildly exhausting. It is a workout every night we go, like swinging on ropes, like descending and climbing over barrels and like sword fights. And, you know, we're doing unarmed combat. Like, there's just so much, and it's an amazing spectacle, I can imagine.
Well, and the thing with that, too, is that it's stage fighting. So you have to learn how to not really hurt each other.
Right.
So you're having to think about that in addition to all of the physicality.
Indeed,
of it.
The dichotomy of like acting and being aggressive and portraying like the story that we're trying to tell, which is, you know, you're fighting to the death in some cases in the show. But also knowing that the person you're working with is your friend and you don't want to hurt them.
They have to be on stage tomorrow night, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
And to prepare them for the fights, the cast actually went through 2 weeks of stage combat training before staging rehearsal started. So they did an entire week on unarmed combat, which Christopher taught. So he's a certified teacher with the Society of American Fight Directors and an associate instructor with Dueling Arts International. That's a lot of words, but he has a lot of training. So he led them through a 1 week unarmed workshop and a 1 week single rapier workshop. So they got some background and skills, and they were also able to test then for certification in those weapons and add that to their arsenal of skills as an actor.
So you're actually
certified.
For both things?
Yep, absolutely.
Oh, how fantastic.
So that gives them a good foundation as they work together, but it really is very physical. Requires a lot of rehearsal, just like in an environment where you have choreography, which also Allie is choreographing for we have some choreography in the show, some dance choreography, but it's very similar. It needs to be rehearsed a lot, and there will be a fight call every day before the show to run through the fights.
Do you think women approach the fighting differently? Is there a way that, because of where our center of gravity is and all of that, and our where our strength is, do we have to think about it differently?
I mean, I can only speak for myself, but I know that my strength is in my legs and not my arms, and this has required a lot of upper body strength. So I know, like, just even talking with the guys, that alone is, like, where I'm feeling the pain is definitely different than where they're feeling the pain. And also, I feel like we have this upper half that we have to deal with.
That we have to protect.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so it does indeed affect your swing. It affects, you know, I guess, yeah, center of gravity is something I hadn't really thought of, but, you know, it is. Marcy has commented on my fighting style, that it has a kind of dancey quality to it, which I hope is good.
I definitely mean it as a compliment. So Allie is a trained dancer and just has beautiful movement. So her fighting style is really beautiful and unique and flowy. And she's a great combatant. Wait till you see her fight. Mm-hmm. She's amazing. But it has this beautiful, graceful quality to it, which I think is just so lovely to watch. So I definitely mean it as a compliment when I say that.
And I hope that if that is the case, that people will note that they'll be like, wow, look at the, you know, the kind of feminine quality to this, like, bloodthirsty. Like, yes.
Well, I think you can. I mean, it's just a different way of approaching that sort of, mm-hmm. you know, need to conquer.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think that's a very human want.
Right.
For some people. Not everybody wants to do that. But it's just interesting to find, you know, how gender influences that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think one of the interesting things that I have talked about to a lot of different people that I've spoken about the themes of the show with is the relationship between Anne and her husband in this play is super interesting and has a lot of parallels with, like, I feel like the possible prospective future president and the role that a man plays in relation to a strong woman. Like, it's assumed that a woman will be supportive and nurturing to her powerful, you know, man, but the opposite is not inherently true. Like, we haven't really figured out in society how to profile a kind of a man who is, you know, supporting his wife, like how to relate to him. And that's a great thing that I think comes up in the show, is that her husband's like, well, I want to be the captain, and she's like, I'm better at this, and you know it.
Yeah.
So I think that that's a really cool and interesting.
And so, Liz, was that something you specifically wanted to explore?
Not particularly. There were a lot of things that sort of grew out of a lot of the table reads that we did. When you start getting feedback from the other actors and you start to see what is the strongest character choice, because I think in one of the first drafts, Anne was very saintly and she didn't have a whole lot of flaws and stuff. And they were like, no, make her a person. I was like, oh, yeah, I'm struggling with the same things that a lot of, like, male playwrights tend to say, because I'm trapped in that gap myself where you just go. And then once you get that out of your head, you're like, I eventually, there were a lot of scenes that I wrote where I just took the names away and I was like, write it, just people. Don't even think about gender. Don't think about anything. Mm. And then the relationship sort of filled in from there. So that was a big step forward, I think, for the show overall. So I think there were themes that I wanted to explore, but they didn't come until later.
What themes did come later?
The idea that, again, like Ali said, where a woman fits in a world that isn't ready for her and what those women's relationships to each other are. And also, I liked to say in a lot of the table reads that most of the characters had circular character journeys as opposed to arcs, where they started and where they ended up, and parallels between different characters. So, for example, Anne's character, her husband and her are fighting for the power in their relationship. And then my character, Heartless Jane Bristow, she ends up going for this guy who's really not great for her as well, and things end in a very different way, which I think is also reflected in how Anne sees things and how a different man's relationship to Anne affects her marriage with her husband as well. And we have a character named Iron Jenny who also has a relationship with a man that's also probably the wrong man, and their character circle ends in a very different place than theirs. So it's just finding ways to complete everybody's story in a really satisfying way, I think, for the audience.
Well, I am so looking forward to this. I love pirates. I love sea shanties. Mm-hmm. I love learning about women that I didn't know about doing interesting things in history, even though, as you say, Liz, this is fictionalized, but it's still based on these people who actually went out there and tried to be different.
And I think this is a good opportunity. It's one of those things where, you know, like a Disney movie, Hercules or something, you would watch it and it would go, ooh, that's interesting. I know they didn't quite do the original version of that. Maybe this is time to take a relook at that.
And I think what's also fun is you have some other very well-known pirates in this play. So maybe you hadn't heard of Mary Read and Anne Bonny, but you've heard of Blackbeard and Calico Jack. So those folks are also in this play. So it's kind of a fun way to bring a lot of those famous pirates and some of the contemporaries together into the same story. But look at how those famous male pirates, what their story looks like through the lens of the story of Anne and Mary.
Okay, well, swashbuckling away. Thank you again so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you.
Liz Shipe is the playwright of Theater Red's season premiere, Bonnie and Bonnie. Alicia Rice stars as the title character, and Marcy Daugherty Elst is the co-founder of Theater Red.
The play opens tomorrow night, and it runs through the 12th of November. It takes place at Wisconsin Lutheran College's Center for the Arts. You'll find a link to more at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and each weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh Air comes your way next, so stay tuned. It is 11 o'clock.
And it's time for us to leave her.